supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, we humans, we mammals, all cry, but why? After all, we shed tears when we lose loved ones and when we're in physical or emotional pain, even social pain, we cry. But we also cry when our children get married or graduate from college. We cry when we're touched, when our heart is touched. There's something about tears. And when we see someone crying, it opens our hearts. It triggers a desire to help. And of course, there's the question, what really is going on with the person who cries? And will they feel better afterwards? We've got a couple of guests here today who can help us understand this more deeply. Jay Efron and Bill Fry. Jay is a clinician. He's a professor emeritus of psychology at Temple. His article, Why We Cry, A Clinician's Guide, appears in the most recent issue of the Psychotherapy Network. Jay, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So good to have you here.
Thanks.
We also welcome Bill Fry. He's a neuroscientist and biochemist who directs Regions Hospital Research Center for Alzheimer's in Minnesota. He's also the author of Crying, The Mystery of Tears. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan.
And of course, we want to hear from you. I know all of you cry and all of you have thoughts about what crying means to you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Bill, let's start with you. You've got a funny story about your work appearing in Peter Carey's new novel, The Chemistry of Tears.
Yes, I was very surprised. I think it was 2 Mondays ago in the New York Times, there was an article about Peter Carey. Of course, he won the Booker Prize twice, I think, which is unusual. And he has this new, supposedly very good novel, The Chemistry of Tears. And in the New York Times, they quoted part of his book, and it was almost directly out of the research that we had conducted, talking about some of the chemicals that we had found in tears and the fact that people, you know, feel better after crying.
Well, how do you feel about that? I mean, I was
pretty shocked, frankly, that to have a novelist sort of use that. Obviously his book is not a science book. It's a dramatic novel. So I was pleased to see that he was aware of the topic to begin with and obviously had seen something about the work we had done.
Well, let's talk in a couple of weeks, Bill. I just downloaded his book, so I'll keep you posted on that.
All right.
On that. You've studied the nature of tears, obviously. All mammals cry, I think, but we're the only ones that have tears. Why is that?
Well, that's a really important question. Certainly other animals do make crying sounds. They do have tears to keep their eyes moist at all times, as we do. But we are the ones who have evolved this ability to shed tears directly in response to emotional stress. And, Darwin originally wrote about this in 1872 in his book, The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals, and said that the overall crying process relieved suffering. But he thought that the secretion of tears was incidental and purposeless. And then Ashley Montague came along, another well-known anthropologist who was at Princeton, years later in about 1960, and said that he thought that crying evolved as a way of protecting us from the convulsive inhaling and exhaling of air that occurs in sobbing, that he thought might dry out the membranes of the nose and throat. And when you cry, a lot of your tears drain from your eyes into your nose through these nasal lacrimal ducts, and they tears do have antibacterial substances, etc. But neither of those ideas really seemed sufficient to me, and I was more impressed with Darwin's theory of natural selection, which says that really we don't evolve abilities like this unless it they have some survival value. And that's when then I introduced in 1980 the idea that perhaps we feel better after crying because we may be removing in our tears substances that build up during stress. We might literally be crying it out.
Well, is there cortisol in tears?
Well, yeah, there is cortisol in tears. There's also, we showed adrenocorticotrophic hormone, or ACTH, which is a fairly sensitive indicator of stress in tears. There's also another hormone that's released in response to stress from the pituitary, which is the hormone prolactin. But these substances have never really been quantitated in different kinds of tears. My theory would suggest, for example, that all tears should not be chemically the same. We have shown that emotional tears are, in fact, chemically different, even though when you cry emotionally, you cry a larger volume of tears than you would over, say, eye irritation by onions. In fact, the protein concentration of emotional tears is significantly higher, but no one has shown that emotional tears have in them higher concentrations of stress-related hormones. It's very difficult to actually carry out those experiments because it's hard to collect emotional tears without interfering with the person crying.
Yeah,
it kind of
screws up that moment, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, it sort of damages that moment, although we did collect tears from people that we showed very sad movies to, and we also had them come back at a later date and collect some just in response to eye irritation. But tears also contain these surfactants, these things that help the tear film spread across your eyes, and that interferes with a lot of the biochemical measures of these potential of these stress-related hormones. So that's an open question, really.
I got to tell you, just on a personal level, what you're saying, what you're researching is really interesting to me and unusual, but, you know, reducing tears to chemicals is a bit uncomfortable. I mean, that tears to me is kind of the currency with which we create intimacy, actually.
Yes, I think that tears are many things. They certainly have a communication function, and that does help to communicate intimacy. But don't forget that many of the times when people cry, there's no one else there. Certainly there is that communication function. Our studies have shown from hundreds of people that 85% of women and 73% of men feel better after crying, less sad, less angry. We also know that different kinds of stress, not just negative emotions, but you can be so happy that you cry. So different kinds of stress, when you cross a certain threshold, can trigger this tearing response.
Let me bring Jay Efron into this. Jay, sometimes when I'm in a session with a patient and I watch them kind of open up their lives and I see that they're beginning to come into their lives, they're opening up, it's almost like they're beginning to flourish for the first time, and when I see that, I often like see them relative to the first session when they were closed down, and I well up with tears at the beauty in front of me, the very human, it's almost a spiritual experience, and my eyes well up with tears, but I don't even know if I could describe the emotion.
Well, you know, it's interesting. my wife would well up in exactly that way when we went to the Wanamaker's Christmas display And they had the fountains called Dancing Waters,
yeah,
I think,
remember.
At the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So when those fountains just came on and the music swelled, she would tear up in exactly the way that you're describing, because there is anticipation and there's tension, and then suddenly everything is working out, and you can let go, you can go off duty, you can let down, you can open up, as you say.
You talked in your article in the Psychotherapy Networker, I think, about sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems.
Right.
Tell us about that.
So I was interested in the fact that, for example, people not only don't always cry in response to sadness, but they don't cry when they are the most sad or the most stressed or when the problem is the most evident. They, in fact, cry when there's a break in that pattern and they can feel safe, they can feel comfortable, they can let go, they can go off duty. So one of the observations that many people have had is that a child lost in a supermarket, for example, may be very dry-eyed and very alert and scan the environment, but it's not till their mother's face is seen as she rounds the aisle that the child bursts into tears. The bursting into tears is when the problem is essentially handled, not while the problem exists. And what's interesting about that, too, is that the mother often says, well, why are you crying now? I'm here. And sometimes, unfortunately, says, if you don't stop, I'll give you something to cry about.
Go on.
Excuse me. But the child is doing it perfectly. No tears during the stage one, the sympathetic arousal, the tension. But yes, tears when the system lets go and shifts into a parasympathetic recovery.
I get that in that circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
But what about tears of joy? I mean, there was, you know, when I was at my daughter's wedding or when I saw my grandson for the first time.
Yes, yeah, so let's say you're a parent at the wedding.
Yeah.
And your, let's say your daughter goes up the aisle, and when she finally says, I do, there's a moment of release. There's
Is
been
release or release, relief?
Release and relief.
Because
there's been, you know, because anything could have gone wrong, and suddenly it's all come together, it's over, it's handled, and again, there's that sigh, and you go off duty and tears flow.
Hmm. That's really interesting.
Incidentally, we use labels like tears of joy and tears of sadness. Of course, the tears are neither sad nor joyous. It's the occasion that causes that shift, and the label we put on that occasion that causes us to call some tears joyous and some tears sad.
I want to press you some more, because there's something in here that either I'm not getting or I'm not agreeing with. What about when our hearts get touched and we cry if we see something in a kind of spontaneous tears that we've all experienced? I'm not aware of any sympathetic involvement. I'm not aware of any buildup here.
Well, like Bill, we really realized that it's very hard to study these things in the natural situation, because people are busy crying and they're not analyzing their situation. So we, too, used films. One that we used was The Miracle Worker. And in that film...
That was the story of Helen Keller.
Exactly. And it's when the teacher is able to get Helen to understand the meaning of the word water, and she finally sees what language is about. So again, this touches your heart because there's been great frustration and great work toward this, and finally it has come to fulfillment. and tears come to the audience. And because it's a play and because it's a movie, you can pinpoint exactly in the script what the, you know, where the tears begin.
Mm. That was J. Efren. He's Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Temple. He recently wrote an article for the Psychotherapy Network called Why We Cry. I've also got Bill Fry on the line. He's a neuroscientist who wrote Crying, the Mystery of Tears. And that's what we're talking about today. Let's go right to the lines. We've got lots of people who want to join the conversation. We'll start with David.
Hello.
Hi, David.
Hi, guys. Hey, I'm calling because I've always been a crier, and I've let them go. Not in public, generally, unless I can't control it. But actually, I'm not that bad. But my comment is that I have definitely noticed that when tears, I call it tearing. When my tears come from a joyous or a spiritual nature or relating to something positive, like an overwhelmingness, they are very, very thin and runny, water-like, albeit salty. Now, if it comes from a self-pity or something like that, a more negative place, they're very thick, and they're endless, and I can smear them. Anyway, they're very thick, and I can keep them coming by rubbing the inside of my eyes. But the difference in texture is noticeable, and I just thought I would mention that.
Well, I before we turn to Bill, that's his area of expertise, I'm going to... You used a word in the very beginning. You said... you talked about crying a lot, not so much in public, you said... You said, I'm not that bad. So what do you mean? I know, I can be a pain in the butt when I pick up these little things. So tell me, what do you mean not that bad? Do you feel it's shameful when you cry in public?
I think we all have to put up a positive front, an image. I was raised, if you don't have anything good to say, don't say anything at all, and there's always someone worse off than you and whatnot. I guess what I mean is... I've had to put up a certain facade. I mean, I've done martial art. I've never cried over pain. Not that I hold them in. I just don't. But I just didn't think it's anything you should do in public necessarily. Now, actually, in the last decade or so, I've gotten over that. I will let the tears come. I've been overwhelmed in public at a concert once. It was a very spiritual in nature. And they were just flowing, and I let them flow, and I always feel relieved afterwards.
I'm going to get the answer to your original question from Bill, but I also want you to know that we've got a show coming up soon about men and emotions and intimacy. So stay tuned. So let's.
Thank you, Doctor.
Yeah, you're welcome. Let's go to Bill first, and then Jay about these tears that you experience differently. Jay, any biology behind that?
Are you asking me, Bill?
Yeah.
Sure. I think, first of all, I think David had a lot of very interesting things to say. With regard to sort of the chemistry between these two emotional situations, I really have no explanation to offer for what he's really experiencing in the difference in his tears there. We have not really observed something in our studies that would really explain that. However, I do want to point out a few other things that you also have asked about. He mentioned that he always feels relief, and certainly that is the case with most of the men and women that we have studied. They do feel relief after crying. He mentioned, as you pointed out, he's used the word bad, and he talked about his upbringing, and certainly in general, it has been traditionally considered that it's not manly for us men to cry. We know that boys and girls under the age of 12 actually all have the same amount of crying, the same crying frequency. But between 12 and 18, we develop a very significant gender difference where women are crying four times as often as men by the time we're 18. He even mentioned having taken martial arts, and this is all sort of part of the he's recognizing this sort of traditional view about crying, that crying is unmanly, that men should have the sort of James Bond image, always being in charge, always being in control. And in fact, this ties in with some of Jay's original observations that I think are quite interesting about crying coming with the release of control, when things are probably coming to resolution. And certainly, we men and our emotions, I think that's a great topic for a new program. You know, women's liberation had a lot to do with what David pointed out about how he feels things have changed about crying and views about crying. It wasn't until women actually stepped forward with the women's liberation movement and said, we don't have to maintain the stereotype of women. We can be more. And that then took some of the pressure off men to always maintain their stereotypic image.
Mm. Jay, I'm going to have to wait till after the break before you weigh in on this topic, because okay, we're running very late. So when we come back, we're going to hear Jay weigh in on this. We're going to also be talking about the therapeutic value of tears. And I want to come back to tears in men versus women, and how that plays out in intimate relationships. We're talking about tears. We're talking about crying today and what it means and what it does and why we do it. We're talking with Jay Ifrit, a professor emeritus of psychology at Temple. He wrote an article on why we cry. Bill Fry is a neuroscientist, and he directs the Regents Hospital Research Center for Alzheimer's at Minnesota. He's joining us by phone. And he's written Crying, the Mystery of Tears. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. We look forward to hearing from you. And we'll be back after a short break. I'm Dad Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
Penn supports WHYY. Do you frequently walk into a room and immediately forget why? Do you need to write things down to remember them? Is multitasking harder than it used to be? If this sounds familiar, you may qualify for a research study focusing on cognition and memory in menopausal women. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness is seeking women between the ages of 48 and 60 to participate in research to study the effects of certain hormones and medication on cognition in peri- and postmenopausal women. For more information, 215-41-STUDY.
So take a good look at my face. You'll see my smile looks out of place. If you look closer, it's easy to trace the tracks of my tears.
That's unfair to end that song early and then listening to my voice. We are talking about tears, and we're doing it with psychologists Jay Ifrit and Bill Fry. Jay, I wanted to follow up on a discussion we were having right before the break about men's tears and women's tears, and
yes,
why men are socialized out of crying. But I wonder, Jay, if some of it is on our hard wiring, that, you know, the hunter-gatherer thing.
I do assume there is an evolutionary aspect to this. Fortunately, our culture is getting better about it, so we now have more athletes crying in public, more politicians crying in public. But men still have trouble with this. So much so that if I have a client that a male client that cries early in therapy, let's say in a first session, I will often at the end of the session say that they may feel funny about this when they get home, and that this is really courageous. It's not a sign of weakness. It indicates problems are being handled. And I say this so that because some clients won't come back realizing they've cried in front of a relative stranger and feeling embarrassed about it. Also, I always say, what is the thought that helped you cry? I never say, what is the thought that made you cry? Because I want to indicate this is a positive event. It is useful to the system. It is a natural process.
That really changes everything, one word. On the other hand, we'll toss something in about how we react to tears. I had a patient last year who had to quit therapy because she said all she did was cry. She would essentially sit down and start crying because she never cried anywhere. And, talk about letdown, Jay, but she quit therapy because it was too uncomfortable for her.
Uh-huh. You know what some people do? So I do think there are differences in lability so that some people cry more easily than others. And some people are aroused more easily than others. But what some people do is they cry and then they make themselves tense again by realizing that they've cried and feeling badly about it.
The shame.
Yeah. And so then their tension rises, and then that tension is again released, and they cry some more. So you may have this, what appears to be an almost continuous stream of tears.
Huh. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Daniel on the line. Hey, Daniel.
Well, I want to thank you for that. I'm an American man myself, and as a child I was taught, big boys don't cry, and, you keep crying, I'll give you something to cry about. So for many, many years I was unable to cry, and fortunately I did some men's work with the New Warriors, who have a center here in Philadelphia, and there is where I really learned to get my tears back to, and I had a bucket full of tears inside of me. And now that I'm able to cry, I look around at all my peers that are unable to cry, and I realize why so many women are disappointed in men these days, because an American man tends to hold back his love. He tends to not want to open his heart and love because he's afraid, because the first time he got his heart broken in high school or whatever, he was unable to cry, unable to process the emotion, and that is the crux of the real suffering. The ability to cry is like freedom from that, and I personally now I'm able to love women with abandonment, and it's a beautiful thing.
All right, wait a minute. Now let me try to be the stereotypical guy out there. All right, so you and I are at a bar with our sleeves rolled up, and you're telling me this story. So here's my question. So what good does it do you? How are you a better person for this?
I'll give you a couple of very concrete examples. When I got divorced and my wife took my son to California, with my blessing, she wanted to move back to home with the kid. And I was able to cry and really emote. I mean, I cried a lot, like every day, sometimes 3-4 times a day. Every time a song, father and son song, would come on the radio, I'd cry. And, so many of my friends, will like curse their ex-wives and say that blobbity blob, I'll hate her guts till the day I die, because I look at them, they were unable to express the grief of the loss of family, and so they it comes out as anger. That's the acceptable American male emotion is anger. So they get angry at the ex, and that causes problems. It hurts the kids. My ex and I have a loving relationship. I go out there anytime I want. She picks me up at the airport. I sleep in the bunk bed with my son. If you were to show up at a family function, you would think we were nothing but the happy little family. And, she knows I love her and will take care of her and to the best of my ability. And my son is really, gotten through this whole process, which is now 8 years in the running, without an emotional damage. And it's a beautiful thing.
Well,
that's just one example.
You've already kind of framed the show we're doing next week on on men and intimacy and emotions. So tune in and maybe call in next week. I appreciate your call.
You know, the caller did say something. He talked about getting his tears out as if they're somehow inside. And we are stuck somewhat in this kind of antiquated steam kettle model of our emotions. We talk about things boiling over. We talk about things being held in. And that doesn't fit the physiology very well. So I applaud the fact that that he is able to process material and express himself. But I think we have to give up this metaphor that somehow things are stored inside and fight for release and cause trouble if they're not released. I think that's an old-fashioned, cathartic point of view that doesn't hold up.
What about history? You know, a history of pain or suffering that gets buried inside. Like a colleague said, all buried emotions are buried alive. They're in there somewhere.
Yes, but sometimes this metaphor of buried and deep and inside gets us into trouble. For instance, I don't know if you are familiar with the point of view of reevaluation counseling, where the notion was you just keep crying and crying until you're finally okay.
Right.
And one of the things that happened in such groups is there were just more and more tears because things simply became re-stimulated. So the notion that this is a kind of quantitative thing and that you kind of cry yourself out, I think is a bit misleading.
Bill, I'd like to hear you weigh in on this.
Sure. First of all, I have to disagree a bit with Jay there, although I don't really want to get into sort of a semantics discussion. I think that Daniel was right on track with almost everything he said, in particular about men and the problems that they have and how that does have a negative impact on their ability to have good interpersonal relationship events. It's important to be able to express your feelings if you are going to have close interpersonal relationships. And many men are not good at that, in part because they are afraid of crying. That's not something they want to do. I also just want to point out that obviously men and women do cry differently, and Jay correctly referred to the societal conditioning, I think, earlier about men crying. But we also know that the human tear glands, our lacrimal glands that make our tears, are anatomically different between men and women. And just like the breast is anatomically different between men and women, and no one's surprised that women can nurse infants and men can't, when you have a structural or a difference between the tear glands of men and women, which I believe is brought about by the differences in hormones, particularly prolactin being higher in the women and present in the tear glands, testosterone being higher in men, also present, that we have to realize that there's some biological reasons why we cry differently also.
I want to address how we react to tears. First of all, individually. So what is one to do when we see someone crying? Let me start with you, Jay.
I think the rule here is the less the better. I think you want to be present, and you want to let the person know that it is fine with you that they cry, but I don't think you want to crowd the person. You don't want to rush in and do a lot of patting and giving a lot of false reassurance. You don't want to say it's going to be fine. This is not an emergency.
All of those things are based on our own anxiety.
Exactly. And I think stem from the fact that when children, very young children cry, we are called upon to step in and simplify the environment and help. But when adults or older individuals cry, we don't know what to do, but we feel we must do something, as if the crying itself was the problem. The crying is not the problem. So, you know, if you're near the person and you want to just touch them lightly to indicate that you're there, that's fine. But this is not the time to ask lots of questions, even if you're the therapist, to say things such as, you know, what is this about? Why are you crying? There's plenty of time later on for interrogations. This is a time to relax and in fact, to enjoy the fact that the person is willing to cry in your presence, which means they regard you as a friend, as a safe port, as somebody that they can be with.
Mm. And could I
go on?
Can I add to that, Dan? I think that one of the things we reported in our studies on human crying behavior in adults was that crying elicits sympathy and empathy very often, and I think that that should sort of be our guide in terms of how to respond. I think it's when someone's crying in front of you, I think it's good to show sympathy and empathy. The one thing you don't want to do is to feel that you need to somehow help them stop crying. You don't want to say, there, don't cry.
Well,
and because they will stop crying when they no longer need to cry. No one cries on and on and on forever. And the problem, as Jay said, is not the crying itself. It's whatever brought about, whatever emotions and circumstances brought about the crying.
So you're both addressing our discomfort with tears, and we're talking about individual, intimate experiences with tears. But I want to back up quite a bit to our culture. And, you know, John Boehner, Speaker of the House, is a crier, and they were talking about how he loses respect. He could even lose his speakership because he's a crier. And 4 years ago, Hillary Rodham Clinton cried once while she was on the campaign, and that raised questions about whether she could be president. So as a culture, what the hell is going on with us, Jay?
Well, we still identify non-tears with strength, as the caller who mentioned martial arts indicated. And I suppose it's because we didn't want our warriors in the battlefield to sit down and let go and give up.
Yeah.
We wanted them to save that for when they got back home.
Yeah, a crying warrior is going to have a very short life expectancy.
Yes. So I think that's where it derives from. But I think Boehner and Clinton are doing us a favor by helping turn that stereotype around a bit so that we can see that this is a useful outward sign that important aspects of our lives are being processed.
Mm. We've got to take a short break. And when we come back, we've got lots of phone calls. And we're going to address the issue of crying in intimate relationships, heterosexual intimate relationships. We're talking with Jay Efrin and Bill Fry. Jay's a professor emeritus of psychology at Temple. And Bill Fry is a neuroscientist and biochemist. And his book is called Crying, The Mystery of Tears. Like I said, we'll be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
Penn supports WHYY. Do you frequently walk into a room and immediately forget why? Do you need to write things down to remember them? Is multitasking harder than it used to be? If this sounds familiar, you may qualify for a research study focusing on cognition and memory in menopausal women. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness is seeking women between the ages of 48 and 60 to participate in research to study the effects of certain hormones and medication on cognition in peri- and postmenopausal women. For more information, 215-41-STUDY.
Don't cry out loud. Just inside and learn how to hide your feelings. Fly high and proud. And if you should...
I'll bet you didn't know I could sing like that. See, you're always learning new things. Actually, I recorded that a couple of weeks ago. We're talking about crying here with Bill Fry and Jay Efrin, and our lines are lit up, so let's go right to the phone. Let's talk with Cassie on line two. Hi, Cassie.
Hi, how are you? I wanted to talk about something that happened with my husband and I. We had a very bad year last year. I had a miscarriage, and I was diagnosed with a bone disease. And my husband, when I had the miscarriage, was emotionless. And when I was diagnosed with the bone disease, and the doctor came in the office and told me what was wrong with me, I wept. And my husband, it was like he was frozen in time. And we've been together for 8 years. We're best friends, but this has changed our marriage. When you don't understand how your partner cannot feel the emotion that you do and cannot express it the way that you do, it's put a huge wedge between us.
Cassie, when did this happen?
I had a miscarriage January 2011, and I was diagnosed with a bone disease November 2011.
Tell me first and foremost how you are physically.
How I am physically now?
Yes.
I was in a wheelchair for a long time, and now I can walk around with a walker. I don't live with my husband. He couldn't take care of me, so I had to live with my parents. So we've been apart for 8 months. And during the 8 months, I go to therapy, and he goes to therapy. And I've worked so hard to learn to forgive him that I find it extremely hard to try and understand why he didn't feel the way that I do, or express why he didn't express his emotions the way that I did.
All right, and before, Cassie, we all weigh in on this, tell us why you called, what you want from this phone call.
I guess I want to understand why, for me, crying is so, it comes so easily, and I cried for 6 months after my bone disease, and I really let myself grieve for the loss of my baby as well, because he sort of hadn't let me grieve for that. And I just find it so hard to understand why men are not connected to themselves in the emotional, in the, they don't have, as far as I'm concerned, the emotional depth that a woman does. Or if they do have it, why don't they allow themselves to access it? It's something that I'm really struggling with. I'm really trying to understand my husband.
All right. Well, I'm going to let our guest experts weigh in on this, but I want to suggest something, that perhaps what you're looking for is not simply an intellectual understanding of men's minds and hearts, because I'm sure you've gotten that. I'm sure someone has explained it to you, but there's something you're looking for that's beyond an intellectual understanding. I mean, your heart's broken. I can hear it in your voice. It's still broken, and there's something you're looking for healing. So we can start with the intellect, but there might be more there that your heart mind is calling for. So let me hear, Bill. Do you want to?
Sure.
See if you can help Cassie understand.
Sure, and Cassie, you know, I have heard this expressed from other people as well, this kind of situation where women just cannot understand how their male partners, whether married or not, to them, don't show their feelings and don't seem to share their feelings. And, you know, unfortunately, as I tried to allude to this earlier, when boys are growing up and they're constantly being told, you know, grow up, be a man, you know, big boys shouldn't be crying, they find out very quickly that it is difficult to get really emotionally upset and yet not cry. And in order to prevent themselves from crying, they start to disengage from their feelings. They really, they don't allow themselves to have some of the depth of feeling that women do allow themselves to have, because they're afraid if they do that they will end up crying, and they're just, it's just pounded into us as children that we, as we get older, that we should not be doing this. And this has very negative consequences, as I mentioned earlier, for maintaining close interpersonal relationships with your wife, your girlfriend, what have you, because, you know, communication is at the core of these things, and it's not about communicating ideas, that it's about the emotions, the feelings. I am sure that your husband was probably heartbroken and in shock about these really awful events in your life and things that happened, but his ability to show it and to even realize it and admit it and feel it to himself, I think were likely compromised by the unfortunate socialization that takes place of boys becoming men.
And Jay, there's another issue here that might come into play, and that's, there's nothing more difficult for us than to tolerate our own helplessness. We'll do anything to cope with that feeling, a terrible feeling of helplessness in the face of a loved one's suffering.
Yes, and Kathy, I hope you make the distinction between what your husband experiences and what he expresses. Because I think in no way the fact that you don't see the tears means that he doesn't appreciate the tragedies that you've experienced. So,
it's really hard for a woman, though, to understand.
Yes.
It's
mm-hmm.
really hard because we are just, we're creatures that can express ourselves. And when you see, you know, my husband tried to tell me that he had to be the strong one, but I don't think that crying is a weakness. I think that crying is a strength, and I tried to explain that to him, and he just doesn't view it like that.
Yeah, he has a lifetime, as Bill says, of conditioning that goes in the other direction.
Well, maybe more than a lifetime.
Yes,
maybe,
mm-hmm.
you know, many lifetimes yes. of our evolutionary wiring.
And when our article appeared, we got a letter from somebody who had a similar difficulty, because the father in the family, there was a death, and the father didn't cry, and the rest of the family couldn't understand why not. So this happens a great deal, and it's unfortunate, and yet we have to allow each person to process in the way they can.
I heard a man in my office once say to his wife around a similar issue, he said, "I was afraid to feel." And mm-hmm. I think that captures it, but he didn't know that for years, that he was afraid to feel. Cassie, I hope this is somewhat helpful to you.
It is. It is. Thank you.
I'm glad. Please take care. I wonder, on another note, in just a couple minutes we have left, Jay, you brought up the issue, or I did when during a break, about crocodile tears, about tears of manipulation. What are they about?
yes, I have a sort of rule of thumb about this. I say if there's wetness, the tears are real, even though they may occur in a situation where the person has something to gain through crying. But I think the tears follow exactly the same mechanism as all tears. Now, that's different from whining, it's different from complaining, it's different from dramatizing, all of which can be more highly manipulative. But I look to see whether there's wetness, and maybe Bill will disagree, but I think if there's wetness, then in fact there has been a shift from the sympathetic to the parasympathetic, and the person is crying over something that makes sense to them.
Bill?
And I do not disagree. And in fact, you know, we did studies where we looked at people how much control do people really have over their crying? And it's shocking how little control most people have over their crying. You know, there was a very sexist remark made years ago, and I'm not going to say by who because I might get the name wrong, but this individual, this man said, the purpose of crying is wholly economic, as every woman knows. I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, and it suggests that, you know, when women want something, they cry to get their way, they're being manipulative, etc. Very few people have the ability to really turn their tears on and off, and most of the time when people are shedding tears, they have real feelings about what's going on. We even had actors and actresses come to our research facility and ask them if they could cry for us, just on, you know, just start crying. And they all told us they could not. The only way they could get themselves to just cry by sitting there would be to remember something really terrible that happened in their own lives, or if they're on stage, to get so far into the part that they felt that this was happening.
So once again, it's genuine emotion. Unfortunately, we are out of time. This has been a great show and really fascinating. Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dan.
I really appreciate it. Bill, by the way, congratulations on your breakthrough efforts with an Alzheimer's medication. We don't have time to go into it now, but I encourage everybody to Google Bill at Bill Frey at the Region Hospital Research Center for Alzheimer's in Minnesota. And Jay Efron, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
I love your work, and it's just great to be with you. Next week on Voices in the Family, Men and Emotional Intimacy. Listen, on Friday, this coming Friday, June 8th, I'll be speaking about hope, hopelessness, and healing at the Patricia Bricklin Memorial Symposium at Widener University, and that's at 10 a.m. in the morning. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com, and our production team is at voices@whyy.org. To download today's show or past shows, we are at whyy.org/voices. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luner is our executive producer of audio content. Today we had help from Emily Haas and Jerome Gallman, and Alexis Kaczmarski. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn's our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends. Christian.